Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter and editor, and Emmy Award-winning producer and correspondent, is one of America's most distinguished journalists. He has covered Washington and world capitals for the New York Times, authored several best-selling books, and created 20 award-winning PBS primetime specials and miniseries on Washington's power game, Soviet perestroika, the global economy, education reform, healthcare, teen violence, terrorism, and Wall Street. We are delighted to welcome Hedrick Smith back to the Tattered Cover to present his newest book, Who Stole the American Dream? Will you please join me in making him feel welcome?
Thank you. Thank you, Charles, and I think it's fair to say thank you, friends. I feel like friends already. Let me just say how pleased I am to be here at the Tattered Cover. I've been here before on previous books of mine, and I'm a strong believer in the importance of independent, locally owned bookstores. This is an institution not only important for book readers, but for American democracy. And I've said that at Politics and Prose and a number of other great bookstores that I've had the privilege to Powell's out in Portland, Oregon, other bookstores that I've talked to recently and their audiences. We need places we can come to find intellectual nourishment, literature, nonfiction, exchanging ideas with people, gathering to hear authors, and just exchanging ideas with each other. And so I think this is a very important institution. And Charles, I'm delighted you asked me to come and speak here. I needed to make a confession to you. This is not exactly the book that I set out to write. This is a reporter's book, and a reporter's book begins inevitably with questions. And that's what I did. I began with a bunch of questions about how we got into the mess that we're in. And speaking of the mess we're in, it reminds me of that old Peanuts cartoon, the one where Lucy has set up a card table in the backyard. It says psychiatry, 1 cent. And inevitably, of course, Charlie Brown walks up and he puts down his penny for Lucy, and he says, Lucy, I want some advice. And she said, well, before I can give you an answer, Charlie, he said, I need you to think of life as a voyage on a great ocean liner. Are you one of those people who takes your deck chair to the bow and looks into the future to see where you're going? Or are you one of those people who takes your deck chair to the stern and looks back to see where you've come from? And Charlie scratched his head for a moment and pawed the dirt with his foot, and he said, Lucy, I'm having trouble getting my chair unfolded. Now, that could be the theme of the night, but I have some other folks that put the point a little bit more seriously. You may remember the name of Louis Brandeis, famous Supreme Court justice who was an advisor to President Woodrow Wilson a century ago. And this is what he had to say, which seemed to me to be relevant enough today, so I put it in the frontispiece of my book. We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. And then there's a comment made about a decade ago by John Gardner, who was in Lyndon Johnson's cabinet and later became the head of Common Cause, the public advocacy group. We are treading the edge of a precipice here. Civilizations die of disenchantment. If enough people doubt their society, the whole venture falls apart. We must never despair. We must never forget or let anger, fashionable cynicism, or political partisanship blur our vision on that point. We must not despair of the Republic. Hard to think of a more elegant way to put it. And so my question was really basically, how do we go from a society of middle-class prosperity and middle-class power and working effective bipartisan politics to political gridlock, starkly unequal democracy, gaping inequalities in our economy, and middle class stuck in a rut? Those are the questions that I tried to follow. And the contract I signed with my publisher, Random House, actually specified that the book I was going to write was The Dream at Risk. I didn't have the title that I have today when I started out. I got led that way. I learned so much in the process of reporting that it changed my title, changed a lot of my thinking, changed what I knew. I was actually going over ground that I had been over before, working for the New York Times, running the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 1970s. And I'm a little embarrassed to admit all the things that I discovered. But what I've tried to do here is to put together a story that we're all sort of vaguely familiar with, but can't really put our hands around, can't make sense of, can't find a pattern to, can't explain fully to ourselves and to each other. And I think that's what really good journalistic or historical books do, is they explain history in a different way. I imagine that some of you have read or know Doris Kearns' great book about Abraham Lincoln, Team of Rivals. And I remember when I picked it up, I know Doris Kearns personally, and my wife and I read aloud to each other. And we actually read that book. It's one of 70 or 80 books we've read aloud to each other. And I remember when we started out, I thought, why is Doris Kearns telling this story about the rivals of Lincoln in the 1820s, in the 1830s, in the 1840s, the 1850s? And then when we got to the 1860s, I understood why. Because the insights and the perspective that we had gained following Seward, the governor of New York, and the senators from Missouri and Ohio and across the country, the team of rivals that formed the core of Lincoln's cabinet, we could understand so much better the political forces that had been at play and the genius of this man, not only the moral genius, not only the leadership genius, but the political canniness, the smarts, the whole skill set that Lincoln brought to bear. And that's what you get out of a history book or out of a book that lays the patterns out for you. So that's what I've been looking for. I've been trying to get the patterns. I've been trying to understand the linkages. And in the process, I discovered all kinds of things I didn't know. I didn't know, maybe you did, that the principal victims of subprime loans were prime borrowers. They were not blacks and Latinos on the east side of L.A. There were plenty of those. But there were many more middle class people, white, black, whatever color, who deserved good prime loans at the lowest interest rates without extra fees. And they got talked into, cajoled into, duped into, bamboozled into, cheated into, all kinds of loans that worked badly for them and worked really well for the mortgage brokers and the banks. And they paid all kinds of extra money. And I've got stories in here of individuals that actually would explain that to. Lots of refinancing. All of which made lots of money for the bankers and took money out of homes of the middle class, folks who owned the homes, theoretically. I didn't realize that before the housing bubble actually had really hit bottom, before it had busted, the middle class, or the homeowners in America, but mostly middle class, had lost $6 trillion of accumulated wealth. Enormous amounts of money. In the late 1980s, homeowners in America owned about 70% of the value of all the homes in America. We owed the banks the other 30%. By 2008, we owned 40% of the homes in America, 70% to 40%, a loss of 30% of the value of the homes in America. Homes in America were valued about $20 trillion. 30% of that is $6 trillion moved from homeowners to banks and investors. Enormous. Probably the greatest transfer of wealth in American history occurred during the housing boom before the bust hit. Didn't know that. Didn't know that the 401k system actually never was intended to be a retirement system for the nation. It actually had accidental beginnings. It was put in the tax code as a favor to Xerox and Kodak by Barbara Conable, a Republican congressman from upstate New York, as a favor to those two companies who wanted to pay additional stock option bonuses, not stock options, excuse me, profit-sharing bonuses to their executives, and they wanted a tax shelter. that would protect it. That's how it got started. We'll talk about it a little bit later what happened to it. So that was a discovery. I kept making these discoveries. I didn't really know what was the source of the political power shift that I had witnessed in the late 1970s while I was running the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. I had no idea that had any connection with a guy named Lewis Powell, who perhaps you remember as a Supreme Court justice named to the High Court by Richard Nixon, Republican president, at the end of 1971. So my story is full of surprises for me, and I believe full of surprises for you. And then I hope what it does is knit together some very important stories. So I'm going to go back a bit to a time that some of you here may remember along with me and may have forgotten a lot about, and then some of you, or at least younger people, don't know. The 1950s, 60s, and 70s were the period when the middle class in America had its heyday. It was a period of great prosperity for the middle class. It was a period of shared wealth in America. The middle class shared in it as much as the people at the top of the economy. It was the time period where Richard Nixon could go to Moscow and have a debate with Nikita Khrushchev, the Communist Party leader. And Khrushchev could boast that communism was going to build a classless society in the future, and where Nixon could turn around, put a finger in Khrushchev's face and say, "We have a classless society." Now, of course, that overstates it. But that was the feeling. That was the self-perception. That was a reality that made the American middle class the envy of the world. And it happened for a couple of reasons. And the reasons are really interesting because they bear upon our problems today. One of the reasons is that from 1945, the end of World War II, until the middle 1970s, the productivity of the American workforce grew by about 97%. An enormous achievement, wonderful achievement of the American economy. And the hourly compensation of a typical American in the middle of society, not just factory workers, but small business people, people who worked in grocery stores and plumbers and carpenters and electricians and so forth, that their hourly compensation grew 95%. Interesting numbers. 97% increase in productivity, 95% increase in their standard of living. That was a time, and that's very important, because what that meant was that not only were corporations profiting, not only was the American economy growing and dominating the world economy during that period, it meant that the middle class was sharing very strongly in the output and the growth in the American economy. Very different after that. It was a time, and this is also very important, it was a time when the CEOs of American corporations had a very different business ethos than we have today. Back then, if you talked to Charlie Wilson, who ran General Motors, or Reg Jones, who ran General Electric, or Frank Abrams, who ran Standard Oil of New Jersey, they would tell you that the job of the CEO was to balance and support the interests of all the stakeholders in the company. Stakeholders, a very important word. Not shareholders, but stakeholders. Now, stakeholders includes shareholders. It includes workers. It includes management. It includes suppliers. It includes creditors. It includes customers. It includes the communities in which the companies were operating. All of them having a stake in the success of the company, and the company feeling it has a responsibility, its leadership has a responsibility to nurture all those interests. So that's one of the reasons why you get this sharing. That's one of the reasons why you get this 97% growth in productivity and 95% growth in people's earnings. Because people's earnings meant people's standard of living. And you had very strong trade unions at that point who were arguing for what I call the American dream, which is a steady job, rising income over your lifetime, maybe not dramatically, but rising, so you're getting somewhere. Health benefits, retirement benefits, enough savings so you could buy your own home over a period of 30, 35 years. And a hope that your kids would live a better life. That was a pretty standard dream. And a lot of American workers had that. And a lot of America had that. Now, one of the things we tend to forget, and I certainly didn't remember it until I got deeply into this, was that middle-class prosperity in that era went along with middle-class political power. What's very interesting, if you follow our history, not just over the last 40 or 50 years, if you go back a century, you will find that when you have high periods of high inequality of income, you also have periods of highly unequal democratic politics. I mean small d, democratic politics. And when you have periods of fairly converged income, what the economists call the convergence of income, the top is not very far from the middle, is not very far from the bottom, you actually have much better growth than you do when you have high inequality of income, but you also have strong middle class power. What am I talking about? Amazing things when you go back to look at them. There was a consumer movement that Ralph Nader led, attacking General Motors for making defective cars that he alleged were killing people. And in fact, that led to a lot of the things that we actually see in our products today. Walk into a grocery store or a pharmacy, you look at the back of a product and you see on the label the contents. Didn't exist prior to the consumer movement of the 1970s. Ralph Nader and company were responsible for that. They demanded that. They got it written into law and a whole bunch of other things. Women's movement lifted the pay of women. Didn't go all the way. It took them from something like 41% of male wages and male salaries up to about 79%. Still had a ways to go to get to 100%, but that was pressure that came from particularly women, but it also came from men who sympathized with women. It was political pressure on the system to deliver better results. One of the biggest things that happened was in the environmental movement, very important to people in America today, particularly important in states like Colorado. It's hard to believe, but on April 22, 1970, 20 million Americans took part in demonstrations against the fouling of America's air and the fouling of America's waterways. People were outraged by the brown smog over L.A., by the chemicals dumped into the Cuyahoga River outside of Cleveland, so bad, so thick that they literally burst into flames. Astonishing. People were on campuses, they were in malls, they were in parks, they were walking in the streets. 20 million people. At that time, the population of America was about 220 million. So close to 10% of the American public went out. And what happened? Within a year, Congress had passed 9 major environmental bills. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Anti-Toxic Substances Act, and on and on and on. Richard Nixon, no tree-hugging environmentalist he, who loved the CEOs of major companies, loved to go down to B.B. Rebozo's place in Key Biscayne, Florida, out in San Clemente, and mingle with the big boys and the captains of American industry. He believed that you had to restrain capitalism and control its excesses. And when I talked to Bill Ruckelshaus, who's a friend of mine, who was the first head of the EPA, which was established, by the way, by this fellow Richard Nixon, Bill said, well, Nixon was no environmentalist. He said, I never could get him really very interested in the environment, but he was interested in politics, and he knew that he had to respond to public pressure. And Ruckelshaus said that very simple statement that says so much about then and now, that's the way democracy is supposed to work. The people demand action, they have a clear agenda, and the government responds. Not exactly what's going on today. So when I'm talking about middle-class power, I'm talking about these movements. And then think of the one that we all remember, and I guess one of the greatest days in my life as a reporter was being present on August 28, 1963, on the March on Washington to hear Martin Luther King. And everybody remembers, I have a dream. I have a dream that one day my children will be able to sit down, little black girls will be able to sit down with little white boys. We have come here today to cash a promissory note from American democracy. What a moving statement. You owe it to us. You promised it to us, and we want it. Within a year, the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Within 2 years, the passage of the Voting Rights Act. That's power coming from the belly of the land. We hardly know what that means today. We vote, and then it's over. Psh, done with it. We've done our job. Not true. That's not what people believed then. And because they didn't believe that was sufficient, and because they got engaged, and because they put pressure on the economic system, because the labor movement was very important too. Not just to members of unions in unionized companies, but the standards they set in negotiations with General Motors, with U.S. Steel, with the rubber industry, the atomic industry, and on down the line. Those became the standards that were accepted throughout the economy by major companies, many of them non-unionized. What the unions gained for middle-class Americans went way beyond the union membership, probably affected and lifted more non-union people in America than union people. So there are all those movements, labor, consumer, environment, peace movement, women's movement, all having an impact on this system. And what happens is much more shared prosperity. Well, then what happened after that was really astonishing. And this is part of the story that I missed. I mentioned before Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell was a famous corporate attorney back in the 1960s and early 70s, so famous he was elected head of the American Bar Association. Practiced from Richmond, came from a Virginia aristocratic family, spoke with a soft Tidewater drawl, and was actually a fairly soft-spoken man. In fact, Linda Greenhouse, the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, reported that in the court, once he was on the bench, Powell would often walk around the court building in slippers or soft shoes and a shirt sleeve, and people from Montana or Texas or Iowa or Connecticut would come into the court building, and they would mistake him for a custodian and ask him the way to the men's room or the ladies' room. But Powell was not soft-spoken about his beliefs. Powell was a staunch supporter of the American free enterprise system. He was a staunch supporter of corporate America. And he saw what I've just described as middle-class power as a mortal threat to the American free enterprise system. And so he sat down at the request of some friends of his at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he wrote what is now known as the Powell Memorandum. It was literally a corporate manifesto. It was a call to arms to business leaders all over America to say, you have got to get into politics. At that time, there were only 175 companies that had offices in Washington to lobby the Congress or to put pressure on the administration to meet their needs of their companies or their industries. And Powell said, business, you're the forgotten person in Washington. Look at labor, look at the consumer movement, get organized. Stop bickering among yourselves. Put your money together. Develop a long-term game plan. Go after your foes. Identify them. Punish them. Vote them out of office. And that is exactly what happened. 5 months after he wrote that memo and it was circulated to business leaders around the country, the Business Roundtable was formed. I don't know if that name is familiar to you, but it should be. The Business Roundtable is the most powerful voice of corporate America in Washington today. It was formed by the 150 CEOs of the largest, most powerful companies in America back in early 1972 in response to the Powell memo. And it is with us today as a very potent force. The National Association of Manufacturers decided, well, if Powell says we better get in the game, we better move our headquarters to Washington, which they then did. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, the arm of small business, had about 4,000 members when Powell wrote his memo. In 1980, it had 600,000, 4,000 to 600,000, enormous growth. The number of companies with offices in Washington jumped from 175 to 2,425 in 10 years. By 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, there were 50,000 people working for business trade associations in Washington. There were 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. There were 8,000 corporate PR people. The corporate lobbyists and PR people outnumbered members of Congress 130 to 1. So plenty of people to go around and lobby Congress. Well, most of us tend to think, and I did too, that the change came about and we saw the result of this, what I call Powell's army, when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 and the Republicans took over the Senate for the first time in 34 years. But actually, that isn't the pivot point in American history. It's just a couple of years before that. The real watershed in American politics over the last half century occurred in the Congress of 1978, controlled both houses by Democrats with a guy named Jimmy Carter in the White House. Now, I have to tell you, as a reporter and a bureau chief in Washington at that time, I did see manifestations of what I'm about to tell you, but neither I nor the people working for me understood why it had happened and what the long-term implications were. With the Democrats in charge, Ralph Nader and the trade union movement figure this is our day. We're going to get some labor laws that will roll back Landrum Griffith and some of the laws that have been harsh on labor and make it easier for labor to organize. And Ralph Nader says, I'm finally going to get the Consumer Protection Bureau that I've been working for all these years. But when you had Nixon and you had Gerry Ford in, you couldn't get them done. Wrong. The bill to set up a Consumer Protection Bureau never got out of the House. The labor bills, there were two major bills, one for common site picketing and one for labor law reform. They got out of the House, but they didn't get out of the Senate. They got bottled up. So these business lobbyists were organized well enough to absolutely block the other side. But that wasn't all. the first thing they got on their side was what I mentioned before, the 401k. It started out as a favor to Kodak and Xerox, but it developed from then on in really massive ways. Under the Reagan administration, some very smart financial guys said, how about applying that to rank-and-file workers? And then after a while, the mutual fund industry said, hey, if we could get our hands on all that money and help people manage it, we could make billions. And they came up with a great slogan, do-it-yourself retirement, power to the people. Why should you let your boss invest for your retirement? You should do it yourself. And do we like that in America? We love the sound of that. That kind of slogan, it's just music to our ears. So people started to flock over to that. And then businesses began to understand that if they actually stopped funding the lifetime pension plans, which had been given to 6 out of 7 workers at any company that had more than 100 employees back in the 1980s, that they could save a lot of money. Hundreds of billions of dollars went from corporate cost accounting to the shoulders of employees. If you had the old lifetime pension system, pension experts tell me companies paid 8 or 9% of their payroll to fund it. If you move to the 401k, even with company matches, it only costs you 2 or 3% of your payroll. So you could save 5 or 6% of your payroll. Run a lot of companies around the country, that adds up to a lot of money. So that got started in 1978. Second thing that got started in 1978 was a revision of the corporate bankruptcy law. Now, this sounds pretty wonkish, and why should anybody care about that? Well, you should care for this reason, and the middle class should care for this reason. Prior to that change in the law, when a company went bankrupt, the company got turned over to the management of a bankruptcy trustee or a bankruptcy referee. They picked somebody neutral without any connection with the company. It used to be somebody who'd probably run another company, retired or left or whatever. And why? Because there's so much pain in bankruptcy. Everybody's going to lose money. Shareholders are going to lose. Stock goes to next to nothing. Creditors are going to lose money. Workers are going to lose money. Management's going to lose money. So let's pick a neutral guy. Let's pick a neutral referee, and he'll parcel out the pain. But they changed it. And the way they changed it was to leave the existing management of the corporation in place and to let that management run the bankruptcy process. Well, it's a reasonable question. What difference does that make? Why does that matter? Well, when they run the bankruptcy process, they work with the bankruptcy judge and the bankruptcy court, and they file a thing called the first day orders. They basically determine, in many ways, the outcome of the bankruptcy even before it's finished. Now, sometimes it takes months and even 2 or 3 years to negotiate all the details because everybody's still fighting. But, of course, the shareholders still lost. The company stock went down to nothing or next to nothing. The creditors got paid, 40, 50 cents on the dollar of what they were owed. But the big losers were the employees. I follow United bankruptcy in my book as a case study. In the United case, the pilots, the stewardesses, the airline mechanics, all the people who work for the company, they lost $4 billion worth of wages, health benefits, and retirement benefits. And if you follow Bethlehem Steel and Weirton Steel and LTV Steel and, I said, United and Delta and Eastern Airlines and now American Airlines, the pattern is repeated. So that change in the bankruptcy law had enormous impact on middle-class wages, because once those wages were lost at those companies, then there was pressure from other companies to get trade unions and to get employees to give up benefits. So it had enormous impact on the middle class. So that's the second thing. The third thing that happened was, and we didn't notice it particularly, was in 1978, they passed a law that blew the lid off interest rates. Up until that time, a number of states, I don't know whether or not Colorado was one of them, but states all over the country, California, Wisconsin, Florida, Maryland, a number of other states, had usury laws. And usury laws said there was a limit to what you could charge in interest for an auto loan or a student loan or a mortgage loan. And it set those limits. This law overrode that. Why is that important? Well, it's important because it sets the train moving towards the subprime crisis. Why? Because banks didn't want a loan to poor creditors unless they could charge them very high rates of interest. If you were charging a reliable creditor, a reliable borrower, 5 or 6%, and then you wanted to give it to people who are poor credit risk, your reasoning was, a lot of those people are going to default, and the only way we can cover that is to charge them all very high rates of interest. So 20%, 21%, 22%. Now, that was supposed to be originally for really bad risks. Ever taken a look recently at your credit card statement, what your interest rate is? We're all paying those interest rates if you're late on your payment. So what they did is they instituted a whole lot of very high interest rates. So that piece of legislation was very important, too. It got followed by some other legislation in the early 1980s, which allowed 100% financing of homes, which allowed variable rate mortgages, which allowed all the things that became the absolute black hallmarks and the pathology of the housing boom and bust. But it starts right there in 1978. There was deregulation that occurred in the trucking communications industry that was also important, but not as powerful for the middle class as the three things that I've singled out. But the last thing that happened in that Congress was something that touched the most political law of anything we have in America, and that's tax law. Jimmy Carter had come in saying he was going to reform the tax law, which he called a disgrace to the human race. He was going to close the loopholes for the wealthy. He was going to drop some poor people off the income tax rolls, and he was going to raise the corporate tax a couple of percentage points. Well, when Powell's army got done with a tax bill, Jimmy Carter's tax bill looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. It was headed in exactly the opposite direction. Instead of the corporate tax rate being raised 2%, it was lowered 2%. Not much, but the important thing is the change of direction. First time that had happened in about 40 years. They didn't drop the lower income people from the tax rolls, and they didn't manage to close the loopholes for the wealthy. In fact, they did just the opposite. They cut the capital gains rate, which benefits all investors, but it particularly benefits wealthy investors who have a lot of money invested. They dropped it from 48% to 28%. Now, today it's 15%. So the biggest single drop in the capital gains rate, which benefited these folks at the top, occurred under Jimmy Carter and the Democrats. Now, I went and talked to my friend Arthur Levitt, who was then president of the American Stock Exchange. And I went to the same college, and I said, Arthur, what do you make of this? I mean, you've got a bunch of political victories here. And he said, you're absolutely right. What I make of what's happened in this Congress is that business has gotten organized. We found out that we can get what we want, and we're going to want more, and we're going to keep pushing. We've tasted power, and we like how power works. I don't know whether or not you have the sense of sports events when the balance of power changes. When the Broncos are in a game, and in the fourth quarter it's a tight game, and there's an interception or a fumble or a long pass or a play gets completed, and the game isn't over. The final score isn't settled, but you know the tilt is gone. The game is shifted. It's a game changer. Or when Nadal and Federer are in one of those tight four-hour, five-set matches, and they're in the third set, and it's 4-all, and somebody gets a service break. And you just say, it may go on, they may have to have a tiebreaker or whatever in the end, but something has happened in the psychology. This is exactly what happened in American politics in 1978. The balance of power changed. And all the players who really know the game knew it. They knew it at the time. Labor knew it. Nader knew it. The Gang of Six knew it. The Chamber of Commerce knew it. Lewis Powell, sitting on the court, never commented about it, but he must have known it too. So that's what got started there. So the power began to shift. And at the same time the power was shifting, and it's been with us ever since. It's even more extreme now, but it all began then. And I can bring you some examples up to date and tell you some stories about people whose names you've never heard of who are absolutely central to the power game in Washington today. And they come from the same Powell's army and their descendants. But at the same time that was going on, something very important started to happen in the American economy. It's what I call wedge economics. Now, that was a controversial term for me to use because my editor said to me, after she read the first draft of my book, what is this wedge economics? Who are you quoting calling it wedge economics? Are you quoting the Keynesians? Are you quoting the Chicago School of Milton Friedman? I said, no, that's my phrase. She said, you can't make up a phrase about American economics. I said, why not? I said, I am trying to get a phrase, a short phrase, a bumper sticker phrase, if you will, that captures a reality that's critically important and put it so compactly, so succinctly, that people will walk away with it, as I hope you walk away with it tonight. And what did I mean? What I meant was from 1973 onward, a wedge was driven into the American economy from the side and began to split off the fate of the people and the upper middle, and particularly at the top, from the people in the middle and the people at the bottom. Just to take what I was talking about before, productivity went up 80% from 1973 to 2011. But the hourly compensation of the average American worker went up only 10%. 80% productivity, 10% wages. And wages means standard of living. And the Census Bureau has added to that in 2011 that the hourly compensation of a typical male worker, and it's important it's male because if you look at household income, it has gone up, but it has gone up mainly because there are, in fact, it's gone up only because there are women working more hours. So if you want to know how average people have done, you have to go compare something that's the same at the beginning as at the end of the period. And if you go from 1978 to 2011, the Census Bureau told us last year, the hourly compensation of a typical male worker went nowhere. Adjusted for inflation, it was exactly the same. In fact, in 2011, it was just a shade lower. 30 years of going nowhere, okay? At the same time, CEO compensation in large corporations went up about 350%, and the income of the people in the top 1% went up 600%. So we get 600% at the top and zero in the middle. That's wedge economics. The productivity goes up, the country gains, corporate profits were rising about 13% a year on average during that period, and wage increases, not adjusting for inflation, wage increases went up less than 1% a year. 13% corporate profits, less than 1% wages. And CEO pay was ballooning with stock options and all kinds of bonuses and so forth. So there's been this enormous wealth gap that's been created largely by stock options. A guy like Larry Ellison, who was the CEO of Oracle, in 1 year, the Wall Street Journal did a 10 biggest hit parades, like a David Letterman thing. Who are the 10 biggest paychecks over the last decade? They did it in about 2005. And they found Larry Ellison at Oracle 1 year got $700 million. Michael Eisner at Disney got $400 million in 1 year. Sandy Weill, who was the CEO of Citigroup, never had a $400 million a year, but he had 3 years right around $200 million a year. So he piled it up. Enormous changes. Now, it's not just me. It's not just a journalist. It's not just Paul Krugman and Stiglitz, Joe Stiglitz, and other Keynesian economists who are saying this. In 2005, Citigroup put out a brochure to its high-end investors in which it compared the inequality of incomes in America to 16th century Spain and 17th century Holland. Advertising Age advised marketers not to bother going after companies that produce for the middle class or even the upper middle class, because 40% of the wealth in America was controlled by the top 1%. So they should focus on the top 1%. Now, these are capitalists. These are people in the economic system saying what the score is. So this is not a tilted, disputed example. If you look at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is the 34 most advanced economies in the world, the most recent figures show the United States has the third highest inequality of income. The only countries in the OECD that have worse results than we do are Mexico and Chile. So if you were worried about whether or not we were going to become a banana republic, we're already there. We have become a banana republic. We have passed Argentina, Brazil, and a number of other Latin American countries. It's just staggering, the inequality of wealth in this country. And it goes with this inequality of politics. Because when you go back and take a look at how the laws get passed, you have an episode like this one. In 2003, when George W. Bush signs the third major tax cut that is benefiting corporations and people at the top, he holds a ceremony in the East Room of the White House and invites the cabinet members and the members of Congress and the committee chairman, all that kind of stuff, who have helped him pass this bill. And he thanks them all publicly. And he thanks my friend Dirk. You've never heard of Dirk. In fact, the president calls him Dirkus. You've never heard of Dirkus. Dirk is Dirk Van Dongen. Dirk Van Dongen is the modern field marshal of Lewis Powell's army. He is the head of the National Association of Wholesalers and Distributors. He is the field marshal of the Gang of Six. And the Gang of Six isn't the six, in this instance, is not the six senators, three Republicans, three Democrats trying to work out some deal to help us avoid the fiscal cliff. The Gang of Six is the Business Roundtable, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the National Association of Wholesalers and Distributors, and the National Association of Restaurateurs. And every time Barack Obama went to try to deal with changing the taxes for the top wealthy and change the extension of the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy and just concentrate on the middle class, the Gang of Six mobilized its lobbying army and blocked them. Now, there were Tea Party people who were of the same frame of mind. There were some Democrats who were of the same frame of mind. It wasn't uniquely them. But they prepared every single time, and I've actually got them in the book. I can show you each time when the battle came up what happened. So that power that got shifted way back in the 1970s that you may think is irrelevant today is not. It is absolutely contemporary American history. And we aren't going to get to a smart fix of our problems today until we understand the implications of the power shift and of wedge economics. And now people are going to come back and say to you and say to me, and they have, look, Rick, this is all very nice. You've done a good job of reporting, but you really just don't understand how economics really work. What's really at work here is the market. This division of income, this lopsided American economy that you're looking at, is the product of market forces. This is globalization. This is what happens. This is modern technology advancing. I have to admit, like a lot of other people, I bought that argument for quite a while. And then a couple of very smart people said, why don't you look at other countries? If, in fact, it's the market, if, in fact, it's globalization, if, in fact, it's China and India and the Asian tigers, then we should see the same pattern of inequality of wealth in other countries. I've already told you that in terms of inequality of wealth, we're down there with Mexico and Chile. So you can run all the way through Japan and Australia and Germany and France and the Scandinavian countries and so forth, and you know they're not as bad as we are. So we got some evidence right on the surface. But the really interesting example is Germany. Now, we're told two things that are very important about our economy. Number one, manufacturing's days are over. Done. Gone with. We had a farming era. Farming went. We only have 4% of our population in farming now. Manufacturing went. We now have to be a service economy. Service is the future. The knowledge economy is the future. Get with it. Get with it, Rick. Get with it with younger generation. Get with it, America. Okay? And the other thing we're told is, we can't possibly raise the wages. Yes, the wages have been flat, but we had to keep them flat to be globally competitive. We could not pay another penny more. We couldn't pay any more per hour, or we'd go out of business and America would be deep in hock and in terrible trouble. Well, if you take a look at Germany, something else pops out at you. Since 1985, big German companies have raised the pay of middle-class German workers 5 times faster than in America. But I haven't actually noticed that Daimler, Benz, and Airbus, and BMW, and the other, Siemens, the other big German companies, are terrible trouble. They seem to be doing all right. It hasn't put them out of business. Makes you want to scratch your head a little bit and think about that, doesn't it? Well, then maybe those companies were smart and they did something tricky and we need to study those companies. But the German economy must be in terrible shape. Well, you need to know in the German economy that average German workers work shorter hours, work shorter years, and make more money than Americans when you make the currency exchange. So the German middle class is doing pretty well and it's got that kind of shared prosperity that we used to have back in America. But maybe the country's in trouble. Well, if you look at the decade from 2000 to 2010, we bought $6 trillion more stuff, a lot of it high-tech stuff, by the way, from China and India and the world, than we sold to them. We had a $6 trillion trade deficit. During that same 10-year period, Germany had a $2 trillion trade surplus. Surplus. They sold more. These companies that were paying higher wages, doing what people told us was like making water run uphill, did it, and did better than we did. That makes you want to stop and ask some questions about whether or not we actually are on the right strategy. And then this business about the service economy, well, we've moved a long ways in that direction. We have 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. Now, manufacturing is really important because not only are those jobs the best paying jobs for the working middle class, who work with their hands as well as their minds, a lot of them working computer-operated machines. This is not the old-fashioned assembly line work. But all those jobs put engineers and designers and advertising people and real estate people and grocery stores and automobile plants. It put all kinds of people to work. So manufacturing jobs are really at the core of an effective, sound economy. We have 9%. Germany has 21%. How did this happen? It happened in a very interesting way. German management and German labor unions sat down together, and they said, okay, what jobs are low-end that we can offshore to China and India and Malaysia and Korea, and what jobs are so important that we want to keep them in this country because they pay so well and they're so linked to product innovation, to manufacturing innovation, so that the engineers are close to the workers. There's a fast flow and exchange of information. Guys like Andy Grove, who ran Intel for 20 years, Jeffrey Immelt, who runs General Electric right now, the guy who runs Dow Chemical, they all talk about the need to keep engineering, design, innovation, and manufacturing together and not to let the manufacturing go abroad, because you lose not only those jobs, you lose the capacity to keep running and staying ahead of the game. So the Germans sat down and they said, this is what we're going to do. And they worked it out. And when the downturn came in the economy and the world started going into recession, labor and management in Germany sat down and said, how are you going to avoid mass unemployment? And they came up with a thing they call the short week. Now, in Germany, the regular week is 37 and a half hours, not 40 hours, as it is in America. But the short week in Germany was 30 hours. So they sat down and agreed that millions of German workers would work for 30 hours a week. So everybody took part of the hit, but the country as a whole wasn't paying huge unemployment benefits. You didn't have pockets of poverty suddenly. You didn't have people who couldn't afford to pay their home mortgages. Think of all the people who couldn't pay their home mortgages because they lost their jobs. So it's a much more sensible way to run an economy. So we got to get smart. That's one of the things we got to do. But my editor said to me, Rick, you can't tell people all these stories about what's happened with wedge economics and the power shift, and I haven't really fully gone into the 401k thing, and I haven't really fully gone into the housing thing. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff I've got in this book that you can learn from. She said, you can't tell people all that kind of stuff and not tell them, how do we get out of the ditch? And I said, Kate, that's her name, Kate Medina. I said, Kate, I'm a reporter. My job is to tell the story. Go find the story, tell the story, lay out the facts, call balls and strikes, be like an umpire, call foul and fair. But then let the people, let the policy wonks in Washington, let think tanks, let everybody else make the policy. If I get into policy, I'm going to start getting policy mixed up with facts, and I don't want to do that. She said, you got to do it. I said, I don't want to do it. Well, my wife is my editor, well ahead of my book editor. And she said to me, Susan said to me, Rick, Kate is right. You got to do it. So I did it. There are two chapters at the end of Who Stole the American Dream, which lay out Hedrick Smith's 10-point plan to save America. Now, I'm glad you laughed. I'm glad you laughed, because that's the way I felt about it too, right? That's the way, I mean, ridiculous, right? I can't even. Well, humor is necessary at this point. But I got to tell you something. It doesn't take any genius to figure out a whole bunch of points. It really doesn't. We have a tax system that rewards companies for moving jobs and profits overseas. I mean, are you aware that companies that operate, and they must have plenty of them in Colorado, that operate in America pay the 35% corporate tax rate or something very close to it, maybe 33, 34? Are you aware that there were 78 American multinational corporations that made billions of dollars of profits from 2008 to 2009 to 2010? Interesting. I thought those were bad economic years, but they were making billions of dollars of profits. And they paid zero taxes. I didn't happen to hear them mentioned among the Welchers and the freeloaders in recent speeches, but General Electric got a $4.5 billion tax rebate from the American government. Now, part of this is they lost money in previous years and they were allowed some tax write-offs. Part of this is they invested in research and development. They get tax credit for that. But the biggest chunk of it is they made money overseas and they don't pay taxes on their profits overseas, but they do get to deduct all their costs overseas. Now, can you imagine a more harebrained idea than that? And then they have the nerve to come and say, look, we have $1 trillion, pharmaceutical companies, Apple, all kinds of companies, IBM, we have $1 trillion worth of profits sitting overseas. Why don't we bring it back to America and create jobs in America. Well, everybody's going to say, yes, that's a great idea. So they come and they lobby Congress. They say, we'll bring it back, but you got to give us a lower tax rate. Congress gave them a 5% tax rate, not 35%, which everybody pays here, 5%, with the promise that, those would go towards jobs. Well, a bunch of economic institutes and think tanks went to work, and they found out that 90% of the money that was brought back, that $1 trillion, in 2005 and 2006, went to pay the executives and went to pay dividends to the stockholders, and only 10% went to jobs. Now, they're doing it again. The Gang of Six has now got another push going on to get what they call a tax holiday. All right, so that's a fairly simple thing we ought to be able to persuade Washington not to do. Another thing that's fairly simple. The banks got bailed out to the tune of $700 billion that we taxpayers paid for. But the banks won't bail out the homeowners that are stuck with underwater homes that are underwater, not because they did anything wrong, but because the housing market collapsed, because the banks were so irresponsible in the way they ran the housing market. And these people are stuck with 8 or 9% loans. And if they got modern loans under today's interest rates, it'd be 3.5% or 4%. Well, the banks would make less money. Let's be honest about that. They'd take a hit, but they got help. It's time for them to take a hit to help out others. But it isn't just helping out those homeowners. What happens is that if those homeowners get a reduction in their interest rates, each one of them every month will save $500, $1,000, $1,500, whatever it is, on their mortgage payment. And they'll go spend that money. And what is that money? That money is consumer demand. We're talking about $800 trillion worth of consumer demand. And remember I said consumer demand is what creates jobs in America. So if we got the banks to bail out the homeowners and we got them to spend the money, which they're going to do because they need to spend the money, we could actually get a jump start in our economy now. So that's another thing we can do. There are a whole bunch of things we can do. I've listed them, and I didn't invent them. I got them from places like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or MIT or the National Science Foundation. There are things we need to do in R&D. We've slipped badly. There are all kinds of very obvious things for us to do. And people will say, well, you can't do that. That's getting the government picking winners and losers. Well, you need to know that Samuel F. B. Morse got a $30,000 grant from Congress to help establish the first telegraph system. Abraham Lincoln passed the Pacific Railroad Act to help build the railroads across this country. Teddy Roosevelt helped fund the inland waterways and the development of the inland waterways. Dwight Eisenhower got Congress to pass all kinds of legislation, you know, to set up this interstate highway system. People have been doing this. Notice those are all Republican presidents. I haven't even mentioned what Democrats have done. It's been going on a very long time. And by the way, stop and think about it. The government is deeply in the American economy. Look at how big the Pentagon is. Pentagon and national security is roughly $1 trillion a year. And then you got NASA and the National Science Foundation. It's not a question of whether or not the government's going to be involved in the economy. It's a question of how and how smart. So that's one thing we got to do. But the thing I want to talk to you all about, and I've overrun my time, and Charles has been nice to let me go, is this. Those things are not going to change in Washington on our policies and on our economics unless we, the people, change our politics. Remember I said middle-class prosperity went with middle-class power. They go together. Unequal power, unequal standard of living, unequal incomes. We need to get back to the same kind of political spirit and civic activism that we had in the 1960s and the 1970s. As long as we are talking about American politics and we say they've got to fix it, stop and think who they are. There are members of Congress who are sitting there enjoying it. By the way, half the members of Congress are millionaires, and slightly more than half of the Tea Party people who were elected in 2010 are millionaires. So they're not going to do a lot that's going to raise taxes on millionaires unless we push them pretty hard. And the lobbyists are all making scads of money being paid by corporations, and they're not going to change the way they're doing things. Now, there may be one or two guys in Washington, maybe a guy in the White House, depending upon the outcome of the election, but they're not going to be people really pushing very hard to change the system unless the pronoun changes from they to we, from them to us. We've got to do it. Now, people are going to say, and we're going to have questions about this, I hope. How do we do it? Where do we start? How can we possibly do it? The cards are all stacked against us. Fine. Just imagine that you were born in a rural county in Alabama. 1920, 1925, 1930. And you'd had to live with segregation. And somebody said, you got to change segregation. You got to change discrimination. You got to change the fact that the sheriff in your county can go around with a billy club and arrest anybody he wants. And there you're lucky. You get to move to the big city. You get to move to Montgomery, the capital of the state. And you get a job there, pretty modest job. And you live with segregation there. What does that mean? Simplest thing in the world. When you go to work, you get to the back of the bus. You got to go to the back of the bus. That's what they say. And they're the powers. They're the big mules. That's the way the system is. And then one day in 1955, a very ordinary black woman named Rosa Parks sat down in the front of the bus. And she said, I'm not going to the back of the bus. You can arrest me. You can haul me off this bus. You can do what you want. But I'm not going to the back of the bus because the system I am faced with is intolerable. And so began the Montgomery bus boycott. And then he had a bunch of students, some of whom I know personally. John Lewis, I covered when he was a student in Nashville, Tennessee, in the first sit-ins in Nashville, in Greensboro. And they said, we want to eat at those lunch counters. We want to eat the same hamburgers and hot dogs and Cokes and Pepsis that everybody else eats, the same way. And they got hauled off the stools, and they got carted off, and they got arrested. And they had people who got on interstate buses, and they drove through Alabama and Mississippi. And they not only got arrested, they had their buses torched with Molotov cocktails. They got literally beaten bloody to their senses. I knew John Siegenthaler at the Justice Department. He got literally knocked out. So did John Lewis. And they kept coming. They kept coming against a system that was stacked against them. Let me tell you, far more heavily stacked against them than it stacked against the middle class people like ourselves today. Ladies and gentlemen, America is not going to get back to the America that we love and the America that delivered a great standard of living, the America that was a model to the world, until we get to that moment when we say with Rosa Parks, I ain't going to the back of the bus anymore. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for bearing with me. I spoke too long, but I'm a little, as you can tell, fervent about this. So some of you will either have questions you want to throw at me, and some of you may have something more solid, either a squishy tomato or a hard-boiled egg. Yes, sir.
Those laws you were talking about, 1978, did Carter veto those laws?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. No, they were outgunned. In the first place, I like Jimmy Carter. I covered him. I actually interviewed him a number of times, Walter Mondale. He was simply outgunned as a politician. These forces were very strong. But for all his strengths, Jimmy Carter came from a one-party state in which the legislature met for 3 months. And that's not adequate training for the White House. He did not know how to cope with what was going on. And Tip O'Neill, who was the Democratic Speaker of the House at that time and had much more political experience, said on the record at the time, I've never seen a lobbying blitz like this in my life. And he was talking about Powell's army. He happened to be talking specifically about labor law reform, but it covered, you know, all that stuff. No, Carter didn't veto it. I mean, you know, and you can ask why. I don't really know why. I think probably when it came to the 401k, he didn't even know it was in the bill. And I'm not faulting him. Neither did anybody else in Congress. When it came to the changing the corporate bankruptcy law, I suspect the White House really hadn't done a very good job of analyzing it. But when it came to labor law reform, they knew they'd taken a licking, and they just didn't want to talk about it very much. And one thing they did do is they managed to raise the minimum wage in that Congress, so they felt, well, we've gotten something for labor. They took a far bigger defeat, and they took a minor victory and crossed it off. I've talked to Ray Marshall several times about this. He was Carter's Secretary of Labor. But I think basically they were just outgunned politically. They were unprepared. They were ambushed. And Carter was not ready for a real confrontation with the Congress. And he, after all, he was dealing with a Congress with Democratic majorities. And the Carter White House, I wrote a book called The Power Game some years ago, and it begins with the problems that Jimmy Carter had with the Democrats in Congress. He had a lot of problems. They didn't run it very well. Okay, somebody over here? Yes?
Do you think the well-intentioned Community Reinvestment Act let the cork out of the bottle for predatory mortgage lending that led to eventually the housing crisis?
Do I think it did? Yeah, do I think the, what was the Community
Reinvestment Act?
The Community Reinvestment Act.
Mortgages were so-called redlined.
Right.
And they tried to eliminate redlining.
Right.
And so it said to the government, try to save the banks, be a little easier
right.
To lend out mortgages.
Right. Basically, this is a question that asks whether or not the government, in its policy to try to promote home ownership, home lending to minorities and less well-off economic people, helped open the door to the subprime crisis. Is that a fair restatement?
Yes.
Okay. I think there's no question that that's true. I don't think it was only that. I mean, I think you had two presidents, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, from opposite parties, saying it's in the best interest of American democracy that we have homeowners and expand home ownership to a higher level. At the time that Clinton was talking about it, home ownership was about 67%. It actually got up above 69% under Bush. But I think it was a policy that was naive. They didn't look at the implications of it. But something else was very important. They were counting on the bank regulators to actually regulate. And Alan Greenspan, running the Federal Reserve, could have continued to impose the requirement for 20% down payments and didn't. Alan Greenspan was challenged within the Federal Reserve Board to say that the Federal Reserve should exercise control over mortgages that were being lent by non-banks. There were lots of non-banks, financial institutions, that were heavily engaged in the subprime mortgage game. And he said, absolutely not, even though there was a consumer credit bill that had been passed some years before that some people said should have caused that. So there was not only a laxness and a kind of a naive democratic urge on the part of the political leaders who wanted the political credit for being tolerant and compassionate, I think the phrase was. But there was a total failure on the part of the regulators to carry out that policy in a sensible way. So I think the two things went hand in hand. But yeah, I would agree with you that the administration's policies were responsible. Yes, sir.
A bubble in housing also occurred in Ireland, in Spain, in Australia. I don't know whether there was an analogous law in those countries.
Right.
I would only like to suggest that I get the impression, not having read your book, that you feel comparatively sanguine about the prospect that American democracy, starting from here, and using methods such as have been used in the past for middle class pressure, will be effective in changing the behavior of our politicians and our leaders. Is that right?
I get the impression that if pressures are applied by the public, as they have been in the past, that I am sanguine that they will be effective in changing the policies in Washington today and turn the situation around. Is that a fair restatement?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm repeating the question. I've been asked to repeat the questions, okay? Well, I think sanguine is overdoing it. I think it's taken us 30 or 40 years to get in the trouble we're in, and I don't expect us to be able to get out of it, if we get out of it at all, in anything less than a couple of decades. And I think we're going to have to chip away at it bit by bit. One of the interesting things about the Affordable Care Act that is largely unappreciated is that not only did it offer health care coverage to 20 or so million people who didn't have it, it is also an income redistribution act. So it's a piece of legislation that starts to move in the opposite direction from the trends that we've had. It's only one, okay? But that's important. The automobile bailout that took place was not only a government-private sector partnership. A lot of people were afraid the government was going to take over and own General Motors and we were going to socialism. But it also led to some very interesting collaboration between management and labor in the auto industry. It was a very painful thing. Lots of people lost their jobs. Cities like Flint, Michigan look like bombed out areas today. But both those companies survived, and the managements of those companies, General Motors and Chrysler, sat down with the United Auto Workers and said, how are we going to help together? How are we going to help these companies survive? And the union said, we'll agree not to push for higher wages for the next 3 or 4 years, if you'll agree to cancel your plans to move a couple of American plants to Mexico, and you'll agree to bring some jobs back from China and from Mexico. And they did. They agreed to do that. Small step, but it's the kind of step that we haven't seen for quite a while in America. So am I sanguine? I guess I'm a congenital optimist. That's my flaw. That's my fault. The situation is terrible, and I do one hell of a job describing how terrible it is in this book. But I am hopeful because I think there are, among the audiences I talk to anyway, there are more and more people who think the country's in terrible shape. And I think that until people think things are really terrible, until they're outraged by the situation, they're not going to move, and they're not going to put any kind of sustained pressure on the system. System is going to resist. I mean, let me tell you, if you think desegregating Alabama was easy compared to what the middle class has got to do today, you weren't there. I was there. And it wasn't easy. So, yes, I would say that I'm hopeful that there are enough signs around that people are upset. And there are a few straws in the wind that suggest we could go in a different direction. Will we make it? I don't know. I mean, I'm with Arnold Toynbee, who says the life and death of civilizations operates by a process of challenge and response. What's the challenge? What's the response? Lots of civilizations have gone down. Ancient Greece and ancient Rome collapsed under the same kind of internal divisive pressures that we face in America today. Odds aren't with us. Odds aren't good. But I haven't said I'm giving up. Yes, sir.
Two questions are probably unrelated. One is the role of judiciary in some of the recent Supreme Court decisions.
Right.
Talk about the civil rights decision.
Right.
And you did the Affordable Health Care Act also.
Right.
I'm curious as to what role maybe the Gang of Six has in that and some of the driving force that may have in the wedge.
Yeah. Well, the question is, has been the impact of the Supreme Court, what role it might have had and its decisions might have had in driving the economic wedge, specifically thinking of Supreme Court decisions on the Affordable Care Act and on the Citizens United decision? Well, I don't think there's any question that the Citizens United decision has had an impact on the way political power is exercised and the power of money. And we're going to see it. We're actually going to see it right in the end of this political race that we're watching right now. And it is one of those issues, back to this other gentleman's question, that really has caused a reaction. Whether or not there will be actually a movement that starts, that seeks to pass a constitutional amendment that overrules the decision that corporations and unions are people in the same sense under the Bill of Rights as we are, individuals, and that Congress has the power to regulate campaign finance, which the court has constantly challenged in one decision or another. Whether or not that will happen, I don't know. But it clearly has had an important impact to date, the court's decisions, and it may cause a backlash. And I think Roberts was sensitive to that. There are a lot of people who suspect that Roberts shifted his vote on the Affordable Care Act because he sensed that the court was looking so out of step with the country that its own credibility, its own status, if you will, was in jeopardy. There's no question that the decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act is having a significant political impact. I think even if Mr. Romney, Governor Romney, and the Republicans win both houses of Congress and he wins the White House, I think they're going to have a harder time rolling back all of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And I noticed with some interest that when there was discussion of this in the first debate, that surprisingly, Governor Romney found a number of provisions of the Affordable Care Act acceptable, and there were other things he was going to get rid of. I don't think he would have said that had the court not ruled. So I think the court has had an impact, and in that case, it's kind of like a crab. It's moved in both directions. Let me just see if there's a woman. I want to make sure. Yes. Listen, I've been waiting. I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you.
Because I don't really remember most of them. I've been too young. But during that 78 period and a couple of years prior to that, were there any major, I guess, foreign policy issues going on at the time that had an effect on what was happening with the domestic economy issues that you're talking about?
Question is, sure, the question is, during the period of the late 70s, when I was focusing on what I call the pivotal Congress of 1978, were there things going on abroad in foreign policy that could have had an impact domestic?
Well, yeah, that's what it was, Iran and OPEC.
Pardon me?
We were talking about Iran. OPEC.
Yeah, sure.
Iran asked for a bit of distraction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sure. There's no question. But Iran comes up kind of late in terms of affecting the legislation I'm talking about. The seizure of the American embassy actually follows the passage of almost all the legislation that I've talked about. So even though it clearly wounded President Carter terribly and may well have swung the election, I don't think it had an effect on the power shift that took place. I certainly don't think that any of the negotiations with the Soviet Union, he had a summit meeting with Brezhnev in 1979 in Vienna, I don't think that had any impact. Certainly the problems with OPEC and the spiking of American domestic prices and the stagflation that we had weakened the president. And I probably should have remembered that in answer to the earlier question, did Carter sign these things? Why didn't he veto them? And I think part of that would be reflected in that the president was in a weakened position. Whether or not he would have chosen to fight, I don't know. But that certainly is a fair question to ask. I think it probably affected not the course of the legislation in Congress, but it might have affected what the president did. On the other hand, any president who decides to veto a piece of legislation doesn't want to see the veto overridden. And some of the numbers on those bills were not encouraging to Jimmy Carter. So they weren't two-thirds majorities, but they were very sizable majorities. And again, I go back to the fact he had never confronted a legislature that had resisted him. His only experience was one term in Georgia with people who met for 3 months. And his staff was equally inexperienced. They were not very good at handling Congress. But foreign policy could have had some impact. Thank you. I think we need to stop there. Thanks very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.